you're going to risk your life on something that isn't your business? Gurov smiled thinly. Panyet said, You mean that this is a matter of patriotism and traitors aren't patriotic? Notoriously not. Pioneers never are. All right, I'll grant that. I don't scoot about space to save the Foundation or anything like that, but I'm out to make money, and this is my chance. If it helps the Foundation at the same time, all the better. And I've risked my life on slimmer chances. Panyets rose, and Gorov rose with him. What are you going to do? The trader smiled. Gorov, I don't know. Not yet. But if the crux of the matter is to make a sale, then I'm your man. I'm not a boaster as a general thing, but there's one thing I always back up. I've never ended up below quota yet. The door to the cell opened almost instantly when he knocked, and two guards fell in on either side. 4.
A show?
Said the Grand Master grimly. He settled himself well into his furs, and one thin hand grasped the iron cudgel he used as a cane. And gold, your veneration.
And gold,
agreed the Grand Master carelessly. Panyet set the box down and opened it with as fine an appearance of confidence as he could manage. He felt alone in the face of universal hostility, the way he had felt out in space his first year. The semicircle of bearded counselors who faced him down stared unpleasantly. Among them was Furl, the thin-faced favorite who sat next to the Grand Master in stiff hostility. Panyets had met him once already and marked him immediately as prime enemy, and, as a consequence, prime victim. Outside the hall, a small army awaited events. Panyets was effectively isolated from his ship. He lacked any weapon but his attempted bribe, and Gorov was still a hostage. He made the final adjustments on the clumsy monstrosity that had cost him a week of ingenuity, and prayed once again that the lead-lined quartz would stand the strain.
"What is it?" asked the Grand Master.
"This," said Panyets, stepping back, "is a small device I have constructed myself."
That is obvious, but it is not the information I want. Is it one of the black magic abominations of your world?
It is atomic in nature, admitted Panyets gravely, but none of you need touch it or have anything to do with it. It is for myself alone, and if it contains abominations, I take the foulness of it upon myself.
The Grand Master had raised his iron cane at the machine in a threatening gesture, and his lips moved rapidly and silently in a purifying invocation. The thin-faced counselor at his right leaned towards him, and his straggled red mustache approached the Grand Master's ear. The ancient Asconian petulantly shrugged himself free.
"And what is the connection of your instrument of evil and the gold that may save your countryman's life?"
"With this machine," began Panyets, as his hand dropped softly onto the central chamber and caressed its hard, round flanks, "I can turn the iron you discard into gold of the finest quality. It is the only device known to man that will take iron, the ugly iron, your veneration, that props up the chair you sit in and the walls of this building, and change it to shining, heavy, yellow gold." Panyets felt himself botching it. His usual sales talk was smooth, facile, and plausible, but this limped like a shot-up space wagon. But it was the content, not the form, that interested the Grand Master.
"So, transmutation? There have been fools who have claimed the ability. They have paid for their prying sacrilege."
"Had they succeeded?"
"No."
The Grand Master seemed coldly amused.
"Success of producing gold would have been a crime that carried its own antidote. It is the attempt plus the failure that is fatal. Here, what can you do with my staff?"
He pounded the floor with it. "Your veneration will excuse me. My device is a small model prepared by myself, and your staff is too long." The Grand Master's small, shining eye wandered and stopped.
"Rondell, your buckles. Come, man. They shall be replaced double if need be."
The buckles passed down the line, hand to hand. The Grand Master weighed them thoughtfully.
"Here,"
he said, and threw them to the floor. Panyets picked them up. He tugged hard before the cylinder opened, and his eyes blinked and squinted with effort as he centered the buckles carefully on the anode screen. Later it would be easier, but there must be no failures the first time. The homemade transmuter crackled malevolently for 10 minutes while the odor of ozone became faintly present. The Asconians backed away, muttering, and again Furl whispered urgently into his ruler's ear. The Grand Master's expression was stony. He did not budge. And the buckles were gold. Panyets held them out to the Grand Master with a murmured, "Your veneration?" But the old man hesitated, then gestured them away. His stare lingered upon the transmuter. Panyets said rapidly, "Gentlemen, this is gold, gold through and through. You may subject it to every known physical and chemical test if you wish to prove the point. It cannot be identified from naturally occurring gold in any way. Any iron can be so treated.
Rust will not interfere, nor will a moderate amount of alloying metals. But Ponyets spoke only to fill a vacuum. He let the buckles remain in his outstretched hand, and it was the gold that argued for him. The Grand Master stretched out a slow hand at last, and the thin-faced Ferl was roused to open speech.
Your veneration, the gold is from a poisoned source.
And Ponyets countered, A rose can grow from the mud, your veneration. In your dealings with your neighbors, you buy material of all imaginable variety, without inquiring as to where they get it, whether from an orthodox machine blessed by your benign ancestors, or from some space-spawned outrage. Come, I don't offer the machine, I offer the gold.
Your veneration, said Ferl, you are not responsible for the sins of foreigners who work neither with your consent nor knowledge. But to accept this strange pseudo-gold, made sinfully from iron in your presence, and with your consent, is an affront to the living spirits of our holy ancestors.
Yet gold is gold, said the Grand Master doubtfully, and is but an exchange for the heathen person of a convicted felon. Ferl, you are too critical.
But he withdrew his hand. Ponyett said, You are wisdom itself, your veneration. Consider, to give up a heathen is to lose nothing for your ancestors, whereas with the gold you get in exchange, you can ornament the shrines of their holy spirits. And surely, were gold evil in itself, if such a thing could be, the evil would depart of necessity once the metal were put to such pious use.
Now by the bones of my grandfather, said the Grand Master with surprising vehemence.
His lips separated in a shrill laugh.
Ferl, what do you say of this young man? The statement is valid. It is as valid as the words of my ancestors.
Ferl said gloomily, So it would seem. Grant that the validity does not turn out to be a device of the malignant spirit.
I'll make it even better, said Ponyett suddenly. Hold the gold in hostage. Place it on the altars of your ancestors as an offering, and hold me for 30 days. If at the end of that time there is no evidence of displeasure, if no disasters occur, surely it would be proof that the offering was accepted. What more can be offered?
And when the Grand Master rose to his feet to search out disapproval, not a man in the council failed to signal his agreement. Even Ferl chewed the ragged edge of his mustache and nodded curtly. Ponyett smiled and meditated on the uses of a religious education. 5. Another week rubbed away before the meeting with Ferl was arranged. Ponyett felt the tension, but he was used to the feeling of physical helplessness now. He had left city limits under guard. He was in Ferl's suburban villa under guard. There was nothing to do but accept it without even looking over his shoulder. Ferl was taller and younger outside the circle of elders. In non-formal costume, he seemed no elder at all. He said abruptly, You're a peculiar man. His close-set eyes seemed to quiver. You've done nothing this last week, and particularly these last 2 hours, but imply that I need gold. It seems useless labor, for who does not? Why not advance one step?
It is not simply gold, said Ponyett discreetly. Not simply gold. Not merely a coin or two. It is, rather, all that lies behind gold.
Now what can lie behind gold? Prodded Ferl with a down-curved smile. Certainly this is not the preliminary of another clumsy demonstration.
Clumsy?
Ponyett frowned slightly.
Oh, definitely.
Ferl folded his hands and nudged them gently with his chin.
I don't criticize you. The clumsiness was on purpose, I am sure. I might have warned his veneration of that had I been more certain of the motive. Now, had I been you, I would have produced the gold upon my ship and offered it alone. The show you offered us and the antagonism you aroused would have been dispensed with.
True, Ponyett admitted, but since I was myself, I accepted the antagonism for the sake of attracting your attention.
Is that it? Simply that?
Ferl made no effort to hide his contemptuous amusement.
And I imagine you suggested the 30-day purification period that you might assure yourself time to turn the attraction into something a bit more substantial.
But what if the gold turns out to be impure?
Ponyett allowed himself a dark humor in return.
When the judgment of that impurity depends upon those who are most interested in finding it pure? Ferl lifted his eyes and stared narrowly at the trader. He seemed at once surprised and satisfied.
A sensible point. Now, tell me why you wish to attract me.
This I will do. In the short time I have been here, I have observed useful facts that concern you and interest me. For instance, you are young, very young for a member of the council, and even of a relatively young family.
You criticize my family?
Not at all. Your ancestors are great and holy. All will admit that. But there are those who say you are not a member of one of the 5 tribes.
Ferl leaned back. With all respect to those involved, and he did not hide his venom, the 5 tribes have impoverished loins and thin blood. Not 50 members of the tribes are alive. Yet there are those who say the nation would not be willing to see any man outside the tribes as Grand Master. And so young and newly advanced a favorite of the Grand Master is bound to make powerful enemies among the great ones of the state, it is said. His veneration is aging, and his protection will not last past his death, when it is an enemy of yours who will undoubtedly be the one to interpret the words of his spirit. Pearl scowled. For a foreigner you hear much. Such ears are made for cropping. That may be decided later. Let me anticipate. Pearl stirred impatiently in his seat. You're going to offer me wealth and power in terms of those evil little machines you carry in your ship. Well, suppose it's so. What would be your objection? Simply your standard of good and evil? Pearl shook his head. Not at all. Look, my outlander, your opinion of us and your heathen agnosticism is what it is, but I am not the entire slave of our mythology, though I may appear so. I am an educated man, sir, and, I hope, an enlightened one. The full depth of our religious customs, in the ritualistic rather than the ethical sense, is for the masses. Your objection, then? Pressed Ponyets gently. Just that, the masses. I might be willing to deal with you, but your little machines must be used to be useful. How might riches come to me if I had to use, what is it you sell? Well, a razor, for instance, only in the strictest trembling secrecy. Even if my chin were more simply and more cleanly shaven, how would I become rich? And how would I avoid death by gas chamber or mob frightfulness if I were ever once caught using it? Ponyet shrugged. You are correct. I might point out that the remedy would be to educate your own people into the use of atomics for their convenience and your own substantial profit. It would be a gigantic piece of work, I don't deny it, but the returns would be still more gigantic. Still, that is your concern, and at the moment not mine at all, for I offer neither razor, knife, nor mechanical garbage disposer. What do you offer? Gold itself, directly. You may have the machine I demonstrated last week. And now Pearl stiffened, and the skin on his forehead moved jerkily. The transmuter? Exactly. Your supply of gold will equal your supply of iron. That, I imagine, is sufficient for all needs, sufficient for the Grand Mastership itself, despite youth and enemies. And it is safe. In what way? In that secrecy is the essence of its use. That same secrecy you described as the only safety with regard to atomics. You may bury the transmuter in the deepest dungeon of the strongest fortress on your furthest estate, and it will still bring you instant wealth. It is the gold you buy, not the machine, and that gold bears no trace of its manufacture, for it cannot be told from the natural creation. And who was to operate the machine? Yourself. 5 minutes teaching is all you will require. I'll set it up for you whenever you wish. And in return? Well, Ponyets grew cautious. I ask a price, and a handsome one. It is my living. Let us say, for it is a valuable machine, the equivalent of a cubic foot of gold in wrought iron. Pearl laughed, and Ponyets grew red. I point out, sir, he said stiffly, that you can get your price back in 2 hours. True, and in 1 hour you might be gone, and my machine might suddenly turn out to be useless. I'll need a guarantee. You have my word. A very good one, Pearl bowed sardonically. But your presence would be an even better assurance. I'll give you my word to pay you 1 week after delivery in working order. Impossible. Impossible? When you've already incurred the death penalty very handily by even offering to sell me anything? The only alternative is my word that you'll get the gas chamber tomorrow otherwise. Ponyet's face was expressionless, but his eyes might have flickered. He said, It is an unfair advantage. You will at least put your promise in writing, and also become liable for execution? No, sir. Pearl smiled a broad satisfaction. No, sir. Only one of us is a fool. The trader said in a small voice, It is agreed, then. 6. Godoff was released on the 30th day, and 500 pounds of the yellowest gold took his place, and with him was released the quarantined and untouched abomination that was his ship. Then, as on the journey into the Asconian system, so on the journey out, the cylinder of sleek little ships ushered them on their way. Ponyets watched the dimly sunlit speck that was Gorov's ship, while Gorov's voice pierced through to him, clear and thin on the tight, distortion-bounded ether beam. He was saying, But it isn't what's wanted, Ponyets. A transmuter won't do. Where did you get one, anyway?
I didn't, Ponyets' answer was patient. I juiced it up out of a food irradiation chamber. It isn't any good, really. The power consumption is prohibitive on any large scale, or the Foundation would use transmutation instead of chasing all over the galaxy for heavy metals. It's one of the standard tricks every trader uses.
except that I never saw an iron to gold one before. But it's impressive, and it works, very temporarily.
All right, but that particular trick is no good.
It got you out of a nasty spot.
That is very far from the point, especially since I've got to go back once we shake our solicitor's escort.
Why?
You yourself explained it to this politician of yours. Gorov's voice was on edge. Your entire sales point rested on the fact that the transmuter was a means to an end, but of no value in itself, that he was buying the gold, not the machine. It was good psychology, since it worked, but...
But, Ponyets urged blandly and obtusely. The voice from the receiver grew shriller.
But we want to sell them a machine of value in itself, something they would want to use openly, something that would tend to force them out in favor of atomic techniques as a matter of self-interest.
I understand all that, said Ponyets gently. You once explained it. But look at what follows from my sale, will you? As long as that transmuter lasts, Ferrell will coin gold, and it will last long enough to buy him the next election. The present Grandmaster won't last long.
You count on gratitude? Asked Gorov coldly.
No, on intelligent self-interest. The transmuter gets him an election. Other mechanisms...
No, no, your premise is twisted. It's not the transmuter he'll credit. It'll be the good old-fashioned gold. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
Ponyets grinned and shifted into a more comfortable position. All right. He'd baited the poor fellow sufficiently. Gorov was beginning to sound wild. The trader said, Not so fast, Gorov. I haven't finished. There are other gadgets already involved. There was a short silence. Then Gorov's voice sounded cautiously,
What other gadgets?
Ponyets gestured automatically and uselessly. You see that escort?
I do, said Gorov shortly. Tell me about those gadgets.
I will, if you'll listen. That's Ferrell's private navy escorting us, a special honor to him from the Grand Master. He managed to squeeze that out.
So?
And where do you think he's taking us? To his mining estates on the outskirts of Asconi, that's where. Listen. Ponyets was suddenly fiery. I told you I was in this to make money, not to save worlds. All right, I sold that transmuter for nothing. Nothing except the risk of the gas chamber, and that doesn't count towards the quota.
Get back to the mining estates, Ponyets. Where do they come in?
With the profits. We're stacking up on tin, Gorov. Tin to fill every last cubic foot this old scow can scrape up, and then some more for yours. I'm going down with Ferrell to collect, old man, and you're going to cover me from upstairs with every gun you've got, just in case Ferrell isn't as sporting about the matter as he lets on to be. That tin's my profit.
For the transmuter?
For my entire cargo of atomics, at double price, plus a bonus. He shrugged almost apologetically. I admit I gouged him, but I've got to make quota, don't I? Gorov was evidently lost. He said weakly,
Do you mind explaining?
What's there to explain? It's obvious, Gorov. Look, the clever dog thought he had me in a foolproof trap because his word was worth more than mine to the Grand Master. He took the transmuter. That was a capital crime in Asconi. But at any time, he could say that he had lured me on into a trap with the purest of patriotic motives and denounce me as a seller of forbidden things.
That was obvious.
Sure. But word against simple word wasn't all there was to it. You see, Ferrell had never heard nor conceived of a microfilm recorder. Gorov laughed suddenly.
That's right, said Ponyets.
He had the upper hand. I was properly chastened. But when I set up the transmuter for him in my whip-dog fashion, I incorporated the recorder into the device and removed it in the next day's overhaul. I had a perfect record of his sanctum sanctorum, his holy of holies, with he himself, poor Ferrell, operating the transmuter for all the ergs it had, and crowing over his first piece of gold as if it were an egg he had just laid.
You showed him the results?
2 days later. The poor sap had never seen three-dimensional color-sound images in his life. He claims he isn't superstitious, but if I ever saw an adult look as scared as he did then, call me rookie. When I told him I had a recorder planted in the city square, set to go off at midday with a million fanatical Asconians to watch and tear him to pieces subsequently, he was gibbering at my knees in half a second. He was ready to make any deal I wanted.
Did you? Gorov's voice was suppressing laughter. I mean, have one planted in the city square.
No, but that didn't matter. He made the deal. He bought every gadget I had, and every one you had, for as much tin as we could carry. At that moment, he believed me capable of anything. The agreement is in writing, and you'll have a copy before I go down with him, just as another precaution.
But you've damaged his ego, said Gorov. Will he use the gadgets?
Why not? It's his only way of recouping his losses, and if he makes money out of it, he'll salve his pride. and he will be the next Grand Master, and the best man we could have in our favor.
Yes, said Goroff, it was a good sale. Yet you've certainly got an uncomfortable sales technique. No wonder you were kicked out of a seminary. Have you no sense of morals?
What are the odds? Said Ponyets indifferently. You know what Salver Hardin said about a sense of morals. Part 5. The Merchant Princes. 1. Traders. With psychohistoric inevitability, economic control of the foundation grew. The traders grew rich, and with riches came power. It is sometimes forgotten that Hober Mallow began life as an ordinary trader. It is never forgotten that he ended it as the first of the merchant princes. Encyclopedia Galactica. Geraint Sutt put the tips of carefully manicured fingers together and said, It's something of a puzzle. In fact, and this is in the strictest confidence, it may be another one of Harry Seldon's crises. The man opposite felt in the pocket of his short Smyrnian jacket for a cigarette. Don't know about that, Sutt. As a general rule, politicians start shouting Seldon crisis at every mayoralty campaign. Sutt smiled very faintly. I'm not campaigning, Mallow. We're facing atomic weapons, and we don't know where they're coming from. Hober Mallow of Smyrna, master trader, smoked quietly, almost indifferently. Go on. If you have more to say, get it out. Mallow never made the mistake of being over-polite to a Foundation man. He might be an outlander, but a man's a man for all that. Sutt indicated the tri-dimensional star map on the table. He adjusted the controls, and a cluster of some half-dozen stellar systems blazed red. That, he said quietly, is the Corellian Republic. The trader nodded. I've been there. Stinking rat hole. I suppose you can call it a republic, but it's always someone out of the Argo family that gets elected Condor each time, and if you ever don't like it, things happen to you. He twisted his lip and repeated, I've been there. And where does it? Two alternatives. Either the Corellians have constructed them themselves, far-fetched, very, but the other possibility is that we are being afflicted with a case of treason. You think so? Mallow's voice was cold. The secretary said calmly, There's nothing miraculous about the possibility. Since the Four Kingdoms accepted the Foundation Convention, we have had to deal with considerable groups of dissident populations in each nation. Each former kingdom has its pretenders and its former noblemen who can't very well pretend to love the Foundation. Some of them are becoming active, perhaps. Mallow was a dull red. I see. Is there anything you want to say to me? I'm a Smyrnian. I know. You're a Smyrnian, born in Smyrna, one of the former Four Kingdoms. You're a Foundation man by education only. By birth, you're an outlander and a foreigner. No doubt your grandfather was a baron at the time of the wars with Anacreon and Loris, and no doubt your family estates were taken away when Seth Cermak redistributed the land. No, by black space, no. My grandfather was a blood-poor son of a spacer who died heaving coal at starving wages before the Foundation. I owe nothing to the old regime. But I was born in Smyrna, and I'm not ashamed of either Smyrna or Smyrnians by the galaxy. Your sly little hints of treason aren't going to panic me into licking Foundation spittle, and now you can either give your orders or make your accusations, I don't care which. My good master trader, I don't care an electron whether your grandfather was king of Smyrna or the greatest pauper on the planet. I recited that rigmarole about your birth and ancestry to show you that I'm not interested in them. Evidently, you missed the point. Let's go back now. You're a Smyrnian. You know the Outlanders. Also, you're a traitor and one of the best. You've been to Corell, and you know the Corellians. That's where you've got to go. Mallow breathed deeply. As a spy? Not at all. As a traitor. But with your eyes open. If you can find out where the power is coming from, I might remind you, since you're a Smyrnian, that two of those lost trade ships had Smyrnian crews. When do I start? When will your ship be ready? In 6 days. Then that's when you start. You'll have all the details at the Admiralty. Right. The trader rose, shook hands roughly, and strode out. Sutt waited, spreading his fingers gingerly and rubbing out the pressure, then shrugged his shoulders and stepped into the mayor's office. The mayor deadened the visiplate and leaned back. What do you make of it, Sutt? He could be a good actor, said Sutt, and stared thoughtfully ahead. 2. It was evening of the same day, and in Geraint Sutt's bachelor apartment on the 21st floor of the Hardin building, Publius Manlio was sipping wine slowly. It was Publius Manlio, in whose slight, aging body were fulfilled two great offices of the Foundation. He was Foreign Secretary in the Mayor's Cabinet, and, to all the Elter sons, barring only the Foundation itself, he was, in addition, Primate of the Church, Purveyor of the Holy Food,
master of the temples, and so forth, almost indefinitely, in confusing but sonorous syllables. He was saying, "But he agreed to let you send out that traitor. It is a point." "But such a small one," said Sut. "It gets us nothing immediately. The whole business is the crudest sort of stratagem, since we have no way of foreseeing it to the end. It is a mere paying out of rope on the chance that somewhere along the length of it will be a noose." "True, and this Mallow is a capable man. What if he is not an easy prey to dupery? That is a chance that must be run. If there is treachery, it is the capable men that are implicated. If not, we need a capable man to detect the truth, and Mallow will be guarded. Your glass is empty."
"No, thanks. I've had enough."
Sut filled his own glass and patiently endured the other's uneasy reverie. Of whatever the reverie consisted, it ended indecisively, for the primate said suddenly, almost explosively, "Sut, what's on your mind?"
"I'll tell you, Manlio." His thin lips parted. "We're in the middle of a Selden crisis."
Manlio stared and then said softly,
"How do you know? Has Selden appeared in the time vault again?"
"That much, my friend, is not necessary. Look, reason it out. Since the Galactic Empire abandoned the periphery and threw us on our own, we have never had an opponent who possessed atomic power. Now, for the first time, we have one. That seems significant, even if it stood by itself. And it doesn't. For the first time in over 70 years, we are facing a major domestic political crisis. I should think the synchronization of the two crises, inner and outer, puts it beyond all doubt."
Manlio's eyes narrowed. "If that's all, it's not enough. There have been 2 Selden crises so far, and both times the Foundation was in danger of extermination. Nothing could be a third crisis till that danger returns."
Sut never showed impatience. "That danger is coming. Any fool can tell a crisis when it arrives. The real service to the state is to detect it in embryo. Look, Manlio, we're proceeding along a planned history. We know that Harry Selden worked out the historical probabilities of the future. We know that someday we're to rebuild the Galactic Empire. We know that it will take 1,000 years or thereabouts, and we know that in that interval we will face certain definite crises. Now, the first crisis came 50 years after the establishment of the Foundation, and the second 30 years later than that. Almost 75 years have gone since. It's time, Manlio, it's time."
Manlio rubbed his nose uncertainly.
"And you've made your plans to meet this crisis?"
Sut nodded.
"And I," continued Manlio, "am to play a part in it?"
Sut nodded again. "Before we can meet the foreign threat of atomic power, we've got to put our own house in order. These traitors..."
"Ah." The primate stiffened, and his eyes grew sharp.
"That's right, these traitors. They are useful, but they are too strong and too uncontrolled. They are outlanders, educated apart from religion. On the one hand, we put knowledge into their hands, and on the other, we remove our strongest hold upon them."
"If we can prove treachery?"
"If we could, direct action would be simple and sufficient. But that doesn't signify in the least. Even if treason among them did not exist, they would form an uncertain element in our society. They wouldn't be bound to us by patriotism or common descent or even by religious awe. Under their secular leadership, the outer provinces, which, since Hardin's time, look to us as the holy planet, might break away."
"I see all that, but the cure..."
"The cure must come quickly, before the Selden crisis becomes acute. If atomic weapons are without, and disaffection within, the odds might be too great."
Sut put down the empty glass he'd been fingering.
"This is obviously your job."
"Mine?"
"I can't do it. My office is appointive and has no legislative standing."
"The mayor?"
"Impossible. His personality is entirely negative. He is energetic only in evading responsibility. But if an independent party arose that might endanger re-election, he might allow himself to be led."
"But, Sut, I lack the aptitude for practical politics."
"Leave that to me. Who knows, Manlio? Since Salver Hardin's time, the primacy and the mayorality have never been combined in a single person. But it might happen now, if your job were well done."
3. And at the other end of town, in homelier surroundings, Hober Mallow kept a second appointment. He had listened long, and now he said cautiously, "Yes, I've heard of your campaigns to get direct trader representation in the council, but why me, Twer?" Chaim Twer, who would remind you any time, asked or unasked, that he was in the first group of outlanders to receive a lay education at the Foundation, beamed.
"I know what I'm doing," he said. "Remember when I met you first last year?"
"At the Traders' Convention."
"Right. You ran that meeting. You had those red-necked oxen planted in their seats, then put them in your shirt pocket and walked off with them. And you're all right with the Foundation masses, too. You've got glamour. or at any rate solid adventure publicity, which is the same thing.
Very good, said Mallow dryly. But why now?
Because now's our chance. Do you know that the Secretary of Education has handed in his resignation? It's not out in the open yet, but it will be.
How do you know?
That, never mind, he waved a disgusted hand. It's so. The Actionist Party is splitting wide open, and we can murder it right now on a straight question of equal rights for traitors, or rather, democracy, pro and anti.
Mallow lounged back in his chair and stared at his thick fingers. Uh-uh. Sorry, Twer. I'm leaving next week on business. You'll have to get someone else. Twer stared.
Business? What kind of business?
Very super secret. Triple-A priority. All that, you know. Had a talk with the mayor's own secretary.
Snake Sut?
Heim Twer grew excited.
A trick. The son of a spacer is getting rid of you. Mallow!
Hold on. Mallow's hand fell on the other's bald fist. Don't go into a blaze. If it's a trick, I'll be back someday for the reckoning. If it isn't, your snake, Sut, is playing into our hands. Listen, there's a Selden crisis coming up. Mallow waited for a reaction, but it never came. Twer merely stared.
What's a Selden crisis?
Galaxy! Mallow exploded angrily at the anticlimax. What the blue blazes did you do when you went to school? What do you mean, anyway, by a fool question like that? The elder man frowned.
If you'll explain...
There was a long pause. Then, I'll explain. Mallow's eyebrows lowered, and he spoke slowly. When the Galactic Empire began to die at the edges, and when the ends of the galaxy reverted to barbarism and dropped away, Harry Selden and his band of psychologists planted a colony, the Foundation, out here in the middle of the mess, so that we could incubate art, science, and technology, and form the nucleus of the Second Empire.
Oh, yes, yes.
I'm not finished, said the traitor coldly. The future course of the Foundation was plotted according to the science of psychohistory, then highly developed, and conditions arranged so as to bring about a series of crises that will force us most rapidly along the route to future empire. Each crisis, each Selden crisis, marks an epoch in our history. We're approaching one now, our third.
Of course, Twer shrugged. I should have remembered, but I've been out of school a long time, longer than you.
I suppose so. Forget it. What matters is that I'm being sent out into the middle of the development of this crisis. There's no telling what I'll have when I come back, and there is a council election every year. Twer looked up.
Are you on the track of anything?
No.
You have definite plans?
Not the faintest inkling of one.
Well?
Well, nothing. Harden once said, to succeed, planning alone is insufficient. One must improvise as well. I'll improvise. Twer shook his head uncertainly, and they stood looking at each other. Mallow said, quite suddenly, but quite matter-of-factly, I tell you what, how about coming with me?
Don't stare, man. You've been a traitor before you decided there was more excitement in politics,
or so I've heard.
Where are you going? Tell me that.
Toward the Wasalian Rift. I can't be more specific till we're out in space. What do you say?
Suppose Sut decides he wants me where he can see me.
Not likely. If he's anxious to get rid of me, why not of you as well? Besides which, no traitor would hit space if he couldn't pick his own crew. I take whom I please. There was a queer glint in the older man's eyes.
All right, I'll go.
He held out his hand.
It'll be my first trip in 3 years.
Mallow grasped and shook the other's hand. Good, all fired good. Now, I've got to round up the boys. You know where the Firestar docks, don't you? Then show up tomorrow. Goodbye. 4. Corel is that frequent phenomenon in history, the republic whose ruler has every attribute of the absolute monarch but the name. It therefore enjoyed the usual despotism unrestrained even by those two moderating influences in the legitimate monarchies, regal honor and court etiquette. Materially, its prosperity was low. The day of the Galactic Empire had departed with nothing but silent memorials and broken structures to testify to it. The day of the Foundation had not yet come. And in the fierce determination of its ruler, the Commodore Asper Argo, with his strict regulation of the traders and his stricter prohibition of the missionaries, it was never coming. The spaceport itself was decrepit and decayed, and the crew of the Far Star were drearily aware of that. The moldering hangars made for a moldering atmosphere, and Haim Twer itched and fretted over a game of solitaire. Obermallow said thoughtfully, "Good trading material here." He was staring quietly out the viewport. So far, there was little else to be said about Corel. The trip here was uneventful.
The squadron of Corellian ships that had shot out to intercept the Far Star had been tiny, limping relics of ancient glory or battered, clumsy hulks. They had maintained their distance fearfully, and still maintained it, and for a week now, Mallow's requests for an audience with the local government had been unanswered. Mallow repeated, "Good trading here. You might call this virgin territory." Chaim Twer looked up impatiently and threw his cards aside.
"What the devil do you intend doing, Mallow? The crew's grumbling, the officers are worried, and I'm wondering..."
"Wondering? About what?"
"About the situation. And about you. What are we doing?"
"Waiting." The old trader snorted and grew red. He growled,
"You're going it blind, Mallow. There's a guard around the field, and there are ships overhead. Suppose they're getting ready to blow us into a hole in the ground."
"They've had a week."
"Maybe they're waiting for reinforcements."
Twer's eyes were sharp and hard. Mallow sat down abruptly. "Yes, I thought of that. You see, it poses a pretty problem. First, we got here without trouble. That may mean nothing, however, for only 3 ships out of better than 300 went to Glimmer last year. The percentage is low. But that may mean also that the number of their ships equipped with atomic power is small, and that they dare not expose them needlessly until that number grows. But it could mean, on the other hand, that they haven't atomic power after all. Or maybe they have, and are keeping under cover for fear we know something. It's one thing, after all, to piratize blundering, light-armed merchant ships. It's another to fool around with an accredited envoy of the Foundation, when the mere fact of his presence may mean the Foundation is growing suspicious. Combine this..."
"Hold on, Mallow, hold on."
Twer raised his hands.
"You're just about drowning me with talk. What are you getting at? Never mind the in-betweens."
"You've got to have the in-betweens, or you won't understand, Twer. We're both waiting. They don't know what I'm doing here, and I don't know what they've got here. But I'm in the weaker position, because I'm one, and they're an entire world, maybe with atomic power. I can't afford to be the one to weaken. Sure, it's dangerous. Sure, there may be a hole in the ground waiting for us. But we knew that from the start. What else is there to do?"
"I don't... Who's that now?"
Mallow looked up patiently and tuned the receiver. The visiplate glowed into the craggy face of the watch sergeant. "Speak, sergeant." The sergeant said,
"Pardon, sir. The men have given entry to a Foundation missionary."
"A what?" Mallow's face grew livid.
"A missionary, sir. He's in need of hospitalization, sir."
"There'll be more than one in need of that, sergeant, for this piece of work. Order the men to battle stations." Crew's lounge was almost empty. 5 minutes after the order, even the men on the off-shift were at their guns. It was speed that was the great virtue in the anarchic regions of the interstellar space of the periphery, and it was in speed above all that the crew of a master trader excelled. Mallow entered slowly and stared the missionary up and down and around. His eyes slid to Lieutenant Tinter, who shifted uneasily to one side, and to watch Sergeant Demon, whose blank face and stolid figure flanked the other. The master trader turned to Twer and paused thoughtfully. "Well then, Twer, get the officers here quietly, except for the coordinators and the trajectorian. The men are to remain at stations till further orders." There was a 5-minute hiatus in which Mallow kicked open the doors to the lavatories, looked behind the bar, pulled the draperies across the thick windows. For 30 minutes he left the room altogether, and when he returned he was humming abstractedly. Men filed in. Twer followed and closed the door silently. Mallow said quietly, "First, who let this man in without orders from me?" The watch sergeant stepped forward. Every eye shifted.
"Pardon, sir. It was no definite person. It was a sort of mutual agreement. He was one of us, you might say, and these foreigners here..."
Mallow cut him short. "I sympathize with your feelings, sergeant, and understand them. These men, were they under your command?"
"Yes, sir."
"When this is over, they're to be confined to individual quarters for a week. You yourself are relieved of all supervisory duties for a similar period. Understood?" The sergeant's face never changed, but there was the slightest droop to his shoulders. He said crisply,
"Yes, sir."
"You may leave. Get to your gun station." The door closed behind him, and the babel rose. Twer broke in,
"Why the punishment, Mallow? You know that these Corellians kill captured missionaries."
"An action against my orders is bad in itself, whatever other reasons there may be in its favor. No one was to leave or enter the ship without permission." Lieutenant Tinter murmured rebelliously,
7 days without action? You can't maintain discipline that way."
Mallow said icily, "I can. There's no merit in discipline under ideal circumstances. I'll have it in the face of death, or it's useless. Where's this missionary? Get him here in front of me." The trader sat down, while the scarlet-cloaked figure was carefully brought forward. "What's your name, Reverend?"
"Eh?"
The scarlet-robed figure wheeled towards Mallow, the whole body turning as a unit. His eyes were blankly open, and there was a bruise on one temple. He had not spoken, nor, as far as Mallow could tell, moved during all the previous interval. "Your name, revered one?" The missionary started to sudden feverish life. His arms went out in an embracing gesture.
"My son, my children, may you always be in the protecting arms of the galactic spirit."
Twer stepped forward, eyes troubled, voice husky.
"The man's sick. Take him to bed, somebody. Order him to bed, Mallow, and have him seen to. He's badly hurt."
Mallow's great arm shoved him back. "Don't interfere, Twer, or I'll have you out of the room. Your name, revered one." The missionary's hands clasped in sudden supplication.
"As you are enlightened men, save me from the heathen."
The words tumbled out.
"Save me from these brutes and darkened ones who raven after me and would afflict the galactic spirit with their crimes. I am Jord Parma of the Anacreonian worlds, educated at the foundation itself, my children. I am a priest of the spirit, educated into all the mysteries, who have come here where the inner voice called me."
He was gasping.
"I have suffered at the hands of the unenlightened. As you are children of the spirit, and in the name of that spirit, protect me from them."
A voice broke in upon them as the emergency alarm box clamored metallically.
"Enemy units in sight. Instruction desired."
Every eye shot mechanically upward to the speaker. Mallow swore violently. He kicked open the reverse and yelled, "Maintain vigil, that is all," and turned it off. He made his way to the thick drapes that rustled aside at a touch and stared grimly out. Enemy units, several thousands of them in the persons of the individual members of a Corellian mob. The rolling rabble encompassed the port from extreme end to extreme end, and in the cold, hard light of magnesium flares, the foremost straggled closer.
"Tinter?"
The traitor never turned, but the back of his neck was red. "Get the outer speaker working, and find out what they want. Ask if they have a representative of the law with them. Make no promises and no threats, or I'll kill you." Tinter turned and left. Mallow felt a rough hand on his shoulder, and he struck it aside. It was Twer. His voice was an angry hiss in his ear.
"Mallow, you're bound to hold on to this man. There's no way of maintaining decency and honor otherwise. He's of the Foundation, and after all, he is a priest. These savages outside, do you hear me?"
"I hear you, Twer." Mallow's voice was incisive. "I've got more to do here than guard missionaries. I'll do, sir, what I please, and by Selden and all the galaxy, if you try to stop me, I'll tear out your stinking windpipe. Don't get in my way, Twer, or it will be the last of you." He turned and strode past. "You, revered Parma, did you know that by convention no Foundation missionaries may enter the Corellian territory?" The missionary was trembling.
"I can go but where the spirit leads, my son. If the darkened ones refuse enlightenment, is it not the greater sign of their need for it?"
"That's outside the question, revered one. You are here against the law of both Corell and the Foundation. I cannot, in law, protect you." The missionary's hands were raised again. His earlier bewilderment was gone. There was a raucous clamor of the ship's outer communication system in action, and the faint, undulating gabble of the angry horde in response. The sound made his eyes wild.
"You hear them? Why do you talk of law to me, of a law made by men? There are higher laws. Was it not the galactic spirit that said, 'Thou shalt not stand idly by to the hurt of thy fellow man'? And has he not said, 'Even as thou dealest with the humble and the defenseless, thus shalt thou be dealt with'? Have you not guns? Have you not a ship? And behind you, is there not the Foundation? And above and all about you, is there not the spirit that rules the universe?" He paused for breath. And then the great outer voice of the far star ceased, and Lieutenant Tinter was back, troubled.
"Speak," said Mallow shortly.
"Sir, they demand the person of Jord Parma." "If not?"
"There are various threats, sir. It is difficult to make much out. There are so many, and they seem quite mad. There is someone who says he governs a district and has police powers, but he is quite evidently not his own master."
"Master or not," shrugged Mallow, "he is the law. Tell them that if this governor or policeman or whatever he is approaches the ship alone, he can have the revered Jord Parma." And there was suddenly a gun in his hand. He added, "I don't know what insubordination is. I have never had any experience with it. But if there's anyone here who thinks he can teach me, I'd like to teach him my antidote in return." The gun swiveled slowly and rested on Twer. With an effort, the old trader's face untwisted and his hands unclenched and lowered. His breath was a harsh rasp in his nostrils. Tinter left, and in 5 minutes a puny figure detached itself from the crowd. It approached slowly and hesitantly, plainly drenched in fear and apprehension. Twice it turned back, and twice the patently obvious threats of the many-headed monster urged him on. "All right," Mallow gestured with the hand blaster, which remained unsheathed. "Grun and Upshur, take him out." The missionary screeched. He raised his arms and rigid fingers speared upward as the voluminous sleeves fell away to reveal the thin, veined arms. There was a momentary, tiny flash of light that came and went in a breath. Mallow blinked and gestured again contemptuously. The missionary's voice poured out as he struggled in the twofold grasp.
"Cursed be the traitor who abandons his fellow man to evil and to death. Deafened be the ears that are deaf to the pleadings of the helpless. Blind be the eyes that are blind to innocence. Blackened forever be the soul that consorts with blackness."
Twer clamped his hands tightly over his ears. Mallow flipped his blaster and put it away. "Disperse," he said evenly, "to respective stations. Maintain full vigil for 6 hours after dispersion of crowd. Double stations for 48 hours thereafter. Further instructions at that time. Twer, come with me." They were alone in Mallow's private quarters. Mallow indicated a chair, and Twer sat down. His stocky figure looked shrunken. Mallow stared him down sardonically. "Twer," he said, "I'm disappointed. Your 3 years in politics seem to have gotten you out of traitor habits. Remember, I may be a Democrat back at the Foundation, but there's nothing short of tyranny that can run my ship the way I want it run. I never had to pull a blaster on my men before, and I wouldn't have had to now if you hadn't gone out of line. Twer, you have no official position, but you're here on my invitation, and I'll extend you every courtesy in private. However, from now on, in the presence of my officers or men, I'm Sir and not Mallow. And when I give an order, you'll jump faster than a third-class recruit just for luck, or I'll have you ironed in the sub-level even faster, understand?" The party leader swallowed dryly. He said reluctantly, "My apologies." "Accepted. Will you shake?" Twer's limp fingers were swallowed in Mallow's huge palm. Twer said, "My motives were good. It's difficult to send a man out to be lynched. That wobbly-kneed governor, or whatever he was, can't save him. It's murder." "I can't help that. Frankly, the incident smelled too bad. Didn't you notice?"
"Notice what?"
"This spaceport is deep in the middle of a sleepy, far section. Suddenly a missionary escapes. Where from?" "He comes here. Coincidence?" "A huge crowd gathers. From where?" "The nearest city of any size must be at least 100 miles away, but they arrive in half an hour. How?"
"How?" echoed Twer.
"Well, what if the missionary were brought here and released as bait? Our friend, revered Parma, was considerably confused. He seemed at no time to be in complete possession of his wits."
"Hard usage," murmured Twer bitterly.
"Maybe. And maybe the idea was to have us go all chivalrous and gallant into a stupid defense of the man. He was here against the laws of Corell and the Foundation. If I withhold him, it is an act of war against Corell, and the Foundation would have no legal right to defend us."
That's pretty far-fetched."
The speaker blared and forestalled Mallow's answer. "Sir, official communication received. Submit immediately." The gleaming cylinder arrived in its slot with a click. Mallow opened it and shook out the silver-impregnated sheet it held. He rubbed it appreciatively between thumb and finger and said, "Teleported direct from the capital, Commodore's own stationery." He read it in a glance and laughed shortly. "So my idea was far-fetched, was it?" He tossed it to Twer and added, "Half an hour after we hand back the missionary, we finally get a very polite invitation to the Commodore's august presence, after 7 days of previous waiting. I think we passed a test." 5. Commodore Esper was a man of the people, by self-acclamation. His remaining back fringe of gray hair drooped limply to his shoulders, his shirt needed laundering, and he spoke with a snuffle.
"There's no ostentation here, Trader Mallow," he said. "No false show. In me you see merely the first citizen of the state. That's what Condor means, and that's the only title I have."
He seemed inordinately pleased with it all.
"In fact, I consider that fact one of the strongest bonds between Corell and your nation. I understand you people enjoy the Republican blessings we do."
"Exactly, Commodore," said Mallow gravely, taking mental exception to the comparison, "an argument which I consider strongly in favor of continued peace and friendship between our governments."
"Peace? Ah!"
The Commodore's sparse gray beard twitched to the sentimental grimaces of his face.
"I don't think there is anyone in the periphery who has so next to his heart the ideal of peace as I have. I can truthfully say that, since I succeeded my illustrious father to the leadership of the state, the reign of peace has never been broken. Perhaps I shouldn't say it," he coughed gently, "but I have been told that my people, my fellow citizens rather, know me as Asper the Well-Beloved."
Mallow's eyes wandered over the well-kept garden. Perhaps the tall men and the strangely designed but openly vicious weapons they carried just happened to be lurking in odd corners as a precaution against himself. That would be understandable. But the lofty steel-girdered walls that circled the place had quite obviously been recently strengthened, an unfitting occupation for such a well-beloved Asper. He said, "It is fortunate that I have you to deal with, then, Commodore. The despots and monarchs of surrounding worlds, which haven't the benefit of enlightened administration, often lack the qualities that would make a ruler well-beloved." This book is continued on cassette number 6, side 1.
"Such as?" There was a cautious note in the Commodore's voice. "Such as their concern for the best interests of their people. You, on the other hand, would understand." The Commodore kept his eyes on the gravel path as they walked leisurely. His hand rested each other behind his back. Mallow went on smoothly. "Up to now, trade between our two nations has suffered because of the restrictions placed upon our traders by your government. Surely it has long been evident to you that unlimited trade..." "Free trade," mumbled the Commodore. "Free trade, then? You must see that it would be of benefit to both of us. There are things you have that we want, and things we have that you want. It asks only an exchange to bring increased prosperity. An enlightened ruler such as yourself, a friend of the people, I might say a member of the people, needs no elaboration on that theme. I won't insult your intelligence by offering any."
"True, I have seen this, but what would you?" His voice was a plaintive whine. "Your people have always been so unreasonable. I am in favor of all the trade our economy can support, but not on your terms. I am not sole master here." His voice rose. "I am only the servant of public opinion. My people will not take commerce which sparked in crimson and gold."
Mallow drew himself up. "A compulsory religion?"
"So it has always been, in effect. Surely you remember the case of Asconi 20 years ago? First they were sold some of your goods, and then your people asked for complete freedom of missionary effort in order that the goods might be run properly, the temples of health be set up. There was then the establishment of religious schools, autonomous rights for all officers of the religion. And with what result? Asconi is now an integral member of the Foundation system, and the Grand Master cannot call his underwear his own. Oh, no, oh, no, the dignity of an independent people could never suffer it."
"None of what you speak is at all what I suggest," interposed Mal.
"No?
No. I'm a master trader. Money is my religion. All this mysticism and hocus-pocus of the missionaries annoy me, and I'm glad you refuse to countenance it. It makes you more my type of man."
The Commodore's laugh was high-pitched and jerky.
"Well said! The Foundation should have sent a man of your caliber before this."
He laid a friendly hand upon the trader's bulking shoulder.
"But, man, you have told me only half. You have told me what the catch is not. Now tell me what it is."
"The only catch, Commodore, is that you're going to be burdened with an immense quantity of riches."
"Indeed?" he snuffled. "But what could I want with riches? The true wealth is the love of one's people. I have that."
"You can have both, for it is possible to gather gold with one hand and love with the other."
"Now that, my young man, would be an interesting phenomenon, if it were possible. How would you go about it?"
"Oh, in a number of ways. The difficulty is choosing among them. Let's see. Well, luxury items, for instance. This object here now..." Mallow drew gently out of an inner pocket a flat, linked chain of polished metal. "This, for instance."
"What is it?"
"That's got to be demonstrated. Can you get a girl? Any young female will do. And a mirror, full length."
"Let's get indoors, then."
The Commodore referred to his dwelling place as a house. The populace undoubtedly would call it a palace. To Mallow's straightforward eyes, it looked uncommonly like a fortress. It was built on an eminence that overlooked the capital. Its walls were thick and reinforced. Its approaches were guarded, and its architecture was shaped for defense. Just the type of dwelling, Mallow thought sourly, for Asper the well-beloved. A young girl was before them. She bent low to the Commodore, who said,
"This is one of the Commodore's girls. Will she do?"
"Perfectly." The Commodore watched carefully while Mallow snapped the chain about the girl's waist and stepped back. The Commodore snuffled.
"Well, is that all?"
"Will you draw the curtain, Commodore? Young lady, there's a little knob just near the snap. Will you move it upward, please? Go ahead. It won't hurt you." The girl did so, drew a sharp breath, looked at her hands, and gasped, "Oh!" From her waist, as a source, she was drowned in a pale, streaming luminescence of shifting color that drew itself over her head in a flashing coronet of liquid fire. It was as if someone had torn the Aurora Borealis out of the sky and molded it into a cloak. The girl stepped to the mirror and stared, fascinated. "Here, take this." Mallow handed her a necklace of dull pebbles. "Put it around your neck." The girl did so, and each pebble, as it entered the luminescent field, became an individual flame that leaped and sparkled in crimson and gold. "What do you think of it?" Mallow asked her. The girl didn't answer, but there was adoration in her eyes. The Commodore gestured, and reluctantly she pushed the knob down, and the glory died. She left with a memory. "It's yours, Commodore," said Mallow, "for the Commodora. Consider it a small gift from the Foundation." The Commodore turned the belt and necklace over in his hand as though calculating the weight. "How is it done?" Mallow shrugged. "That's a question for our technical experts, but it will work for you without, mark you, without priestly help."
"Well, it's only feminine frippery, after all. What could you do with it? Where would the money come in?"
"You have balls, receptions, banquets, that sort of thing."
"Oh, yes."
"Do you realize what women will pay for that sort of jewelry? 10,000 credits, at least." The Commodore seemed struck in a heap.
"Ah."
"And since the power unit of this particular item will not last longer than 6 months, there will be the necessity of frequent replacements. Now, we can sell as many of these as you want for the equivalent in wrought iron of 1,000 credits. There's 900% profit for you." The Commodore plucked at his beard and seemed engaged in awesome mental calculations.
"Galaxy, how the dowagers will fight for them. I'll keep the supply small and let them bid. Of course, it wouldn't do to let them know that I personally..."
Mallow said, "We can explain the workings of dummy corporations if you would like. Then, working further at random, take our complete line of household gadgets. We have collapsible stoves that will roast the toughest meats to the desired tenderness in 2 minutes. We've got knives that won't require sharpening. We've got the equivalent of a complete laundry that can be packed in a small closet and will work entirely automatically. Ditto dishwashers, ditto ditto floor scrubbers, furniture polishers, desk precipitators, lighting fixtures. Oh, anything you like. Think of your increased popularity if you make them available to the public. Think of your increased quantity of worldly goods if they're available as a government monopoly at 900% profit. It will be worth many times the money to them, and they didn't know what you pay for it. And mind you, none of it will require priestly supervision. Everybody will be happy."
"Except you, it seems. What do you get out of it?"
"Just what every trader gets by Foundation law. My men and I will collect half of whatever profits we take in. Just you buy all I want to sell you, and we'll both make out quite well. Quite well." The Commodore was enjoying his thoughts.
"What did you say you wanted to be paid with? Iron?"
"That, and coal, and bauxite. Also tobacco, pepper, magnesium, hardwood. Nothing you haven't got enough of."
"It sounds well."
"I think so. Oh, and still another item at random, Commodore. I could retool your factories."
"Eh? How's that?"
"Well, take your steel foundries. I have handy little gadgets that could do tricks with steel that would cut production costs to 1% of previous marks. You could cut prices by half and still split extremely fat profits with the manufacturers. I tell you, I could show you exactly what I mean if you allowed me a demonstration. Do you have a steel foundry in this city? It wouldn't take long."
"It could be arranged, Trader Mallow. But tomorrow, would you dine with us tonight?"
"My men..." began Mallow.
"Let them all come," said the Commodore expansively. "A symbolic friendly union of our nations. It will give us a chance for further friendly discussion. But one thing..."
His face lengthened and grew stern.
"None of your religion. Don't think that all this is an entering wedge for the missionaries."
"Commodore," said Mallow dryly, "I give you my word that religion would cut my profits."
"Then that will do for now. You'll be escorted back to your ship."
6. The Commodora was much younger than her husband. Her face was pale and coldly formed, and her black hair was drawn smoothly and tightly back. Her voice was tart.
"You are quite finished, my gracious and noble husband? Quite, quite finished? I suppose I may even enter the garden if I wish now?"
"There is no need for dramatics, Leisha, my dear," said the Commodore mildly. "The young man will attend at dinner tonight, and you can speak with him all you wish and even amuse yourself by listening to all I say. Room will have to be arranged for his men somewhere about the place.
the stars grant that they be few in numbers.
Most likely they'll be great hogs of eaters who will eat meat by the quarter animal and wine by the hogshead, and you will groan for 2 nights when you calculate the expense.
Well, now, perhaps I won't. Despite your opinion, the dinner is to be on the most lavish scale.
Oh, I see.
She stared at him contemptuously.
You are very friendly with these barbarians. Perhaps that is why I was not to be permitted to attend your conversation.